Hello, I'm Julia Baird. Welcome to Swan Songs, the series where we ask guests to tell us what the years have taught them about themselves and this mysterious business called life. And how would they like to be farewelled when it's all over, if they'd like to be farewelled at all? Our guest today is Greg Fleet, the Melbourne stand-up comedian who has turned his life into a laughing matter. Even if in reality, much of it has been no joke, given a 30-year-long heroin addiction and a father who faked his own death. Now in recovery, Greg is hopeful about the future, but also clear-eyed about the past. Take, say, his view on how he'd sum up his life so far.
I would say a huge amount of underachievement. I don't feel like I've achieved much at all. And I look around at my contemporaries who seem to be getting a lot more done and, you know, pursuing ideas and getting people to have faith in them and stuff like that. And, you know, I haven't really done that. I'm trying to do it now. But having had a reputation in the past for drug use and stuff like that, I don't know how much that works against me. I'm sure it does.
What would you be content with then?
Look, I don't know that we're ever content. You know, at the beginning of my career, what I laughingly refer to as my career, if someone had said to me, you can be on television, you know, or you can be in a TV show, like, you know, a soap opera or whatever, you know, you can do that for a couple of weeks, but that's it. You know, if you take this deal, you know, that's all you're going to do. I would have taken that deal. I just would have thought, oh my God, imagine that.
You've done that.
I know.
But you're not content.
No, that's the thing. I think that, you know, you always look ahead and see something and you go, if I could just get that, I'd be the happiest man in the world and I could retire. And, you know, if I could do that, that would be all I wanted. And then you do that and you look ahead and there are other people doing interesting things ahead of that. And you think, no, I've got to go for that.
Right. So it's an unsated kind of ambition. But you're talking about is professional success. I mean, what about the other great moments of joy or happiness or contentment in your life? What have you learnt about those things?
Yet again, I feel like I've underachieved. You know, I feel like, you know, as a father, I have a great relationship with my daughter and with her mum, but that's primarily down to her mum being an incredible person.
What have you done right then?
Oh, that's an interesting question. A lot of things, you know, like all the things that I say I could have done better, I certainly could have done all of them worse as well, you know. I've written, you know, TV shows, series that have gone to air. I've written plays and, you know, one recently. I've written a book. Hopefully I'm going to be writing another one based around a lot of the stuff that we're talking about, actually. I've had a child and have a very positive relationship with her. I mean, she loves me wholeheartedly and I feel the same way and, you know, that's a great thing.
When you talk about being a father, obviously something that will have influenced that a great deal is your relationship with your own father. He was quite an unusual man.
Yeah.
You know, an unusual childhood and presumably very painful at certain times. Your father left the family when you were 10. Can you tell us what happened?
I don't ever remember feeling an enormous amount of pain about any of this because I think you only have one life. So it's not like you've had some perfect fairy story upbringing and everything was great and then you're doing it again and you've got that to compare it to and go, oh, it was much better last time. I mean, you only have what you know you have. So you don't really have anything to compare it to. I suppose you could compare it to other people's families or something. But
it must be reasonably unusual to have your father drop you off at school and then fake his own suicide.
Well, that's how annoying I can be as a person, as a child. I was that annoying that my father had to fake his own death.
Is that what you thought?
No, I didn't. See, that's the thing. I don't remember any moments of, you know, really incredibly great sorrow or pain. I don't know why. Maybe I just blocked it out and that's, you know, maybe the result of that is some of my behaviour as an adult and some of my, you know, irresponsibility and addictions and stuff like that. But I don't remember it ever being incredibly painful or anything. It's just what it was. I mean, basically what happened was my father was a bigamist. He was incredibly unfaithful to my mother, like all over the place. He'd slept with everyone. He slept with all his mates' wives. He slept with, you know, all my mum's friends. He was incorrigible. And he was a designer with Ford Motor Company. That's why we came to Australia from America when I was a little kid. He got transferred out here. He ended up going to business for himself and the business went a bit haywire and he owed money and stuff like that. And I think he just turned around one day and went, I want out. And he, you know, his marriage wasn't working. As I said, he was sleeping with everyone he met, basically. He was very handsome and very charming and not unlike me. Yeah. And he one day, dropped me off at school and then left his car on a pier and left a note with his solicitor basically implying, I don't know that he ever came out and said it flat out, but it was very clear what was going on. And he basically faked his own death. And for a couple of years, everyone thought he was dead, as far as I know. And he'd remarried under a false name. He created a false identity. And he'd actually had children. And then one day, someone saw him. He'd lived overseas. And he'd met this new partner in Queensland. And he'd lived up there for a long time. Her father owned real estate companies in Melbourne. And he offered him the managership of one of them or something like that. And my father said yes and came to Melbourne to do that. And then one day, someone ran into him and told my mother. And she walked into his office a little while after that. And you can imagine he would have been a little bit disturbed. And then he is so smooth, he basically dumped his new family and convinced my mother that he was still in love with her and that everything would work out this time so that she wouldn't pursue him in the courts, I guess. And he came back and they were together for maybe another year or a bit less, and he did the same thing again. He didn't fake his death this time, but he just did the same thing, dropped us at school and split, and, you know, was not findable for a long time.
That's a huge thing to have happen to you as a kid, though. And you're saying you can't remember sorrow, but...
You know, it sounds like a huge thing to have happen to you, but as I said, it's just what happened. So you don't have anything to compare it to. It's just the life that you had. You know, I'm not being stoic when I say that. I'm not being brave or anything. You know,
but did it affect the way you feel about or you think about love?
No, I don't think so. And I'm really proud of myself for that not being the case, because I think very much a romantic. I fall in love, and you know, I've been in love maybe, I don't know, four or five times in my life, which is a lot, I think. I don't think it's affected my approach to love or anything like that. As I said, I've been in love a few times, and I am a romantic, and I love being in love. I mean, if anything, I have to be careful not to just chase the concept, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've spoken about something that has held you back as a father, as a partner, and also as a comedian. For decades, you were addicted to heroin. You've spoken about it before. You've given up somewhere about 30 times, but you're now in recovery. What did you learn from those years of addiction?
Probably, you know, a hell of a lot. Yet again, it's hard to say, because that was just the life that I had. And, you know, from the age of 19 or 20, through to very recently, up to like a year ago, that was what I did. I mean, I did other things, obviously. I worked and, you know, I had relationships and did things, but it had a negative effect on all of those things. But it probably also in some ways had a positive effect. You know, I achieved certain things and I did certain things with my life. It's hard to know what effect heroin had on those things. I mean, I feel generally it held me back. But, you know, there in some ways it maybe freed me up for other things. You know, it's definitely hard to know. But
you sound like you've still got a lingering fondness or attachment.
Oh, I think I'll always have that. Like, people have often said, you know, taking heroin, were you more inspired and all that kind of thing? I could definitely say no to that. It certainly doesn't make you better at anything.
Right, that creative myth.
Yeah, no, yep. I don't think that's true. I mean, you look at all those people that people look up to, and I certainly did, you know, as an aspiring drug addict and artist. You know, you look at all those people like, you know, William Burroughs and Keith Richards and, you know, whoever, all those creative people that also took hard drugs. I tend to think, and I may be wrong here, but I tend to think they would probably have got more done had they not been drug addicts, you know. And it's not a case of, you know, they were drug addicts and that made them great at what they do. Not at all. You know, Keith Richards was a great guitar player. You know, he didn't become a great guitar player because he was a drug addict. You know, he was always a great guitar player and then found drugs.
But what about what it does to you as a person and to your kind of web of friendships? Because, you know, often people talk about the need to deceive people. Yeah. Mm. Tell us about
that. Oh, it's absolutely, you know, I probably sound blasé about it, but it's horrible. You know, you become, well, untrustworthy, you lie, you cheat, you know, it's really quite bad. And because it's an essential thing, you have to do it to get through a day. It's your primary concern, you know, it's the first thing that must be done. And then hopefully you can do all the other things, you know, in that day, you know, having friendships and doing all that kind of stuff. But all of that stuff ends up suffering, you know, in the end. And
was there a particular moment when you realized, I've got to change, I've got to get out of this?
I think I probably had that feeling a lot of times over the years, and then I would stop, and for whatever reasons, you know, very soon after that I would start again. I think more recently, you know, in the last couple of years, I reached a point where I went, oh my God, you know, my ego is such that, you know, I want to achieve more things. If I want to do those things, I can't keep using, because I'm just not going to, you know, I won't have the time. It takes up so much of your time and energy and focus that, you know, I won't get these other things done, and people won't trust me to get them done, and, you know, people won't want to invest money into something that I'm doing, you know, for fear that I'll drop dead or that I'll not do it and just spend the money or whatever. So, yeah, more recently, I think it got down to that. It got down to, you know, wanting to have a relationship with my daughter and wanting to have a legacy that I could leave behind for myself, but also for her, you know, where she could go, yeah, my dad did that. You know, he wrote that great film, or he wrote this book, or, you know, whatever. You know, I'm very proud of some of the things that I have created already, but if, you know, I want to do a couple more that are really, really awesome that I can leave behind. And if I want to do that, I can't, you know, use heroin. It just doesn't work.
You are with Swan Songs on Radio National. I'm Julia Baird, and I'm talking to Greg Fleet, comic and actor. Now, Greg, you have also had a near-death experience. Years ago in Bangkok, you were kidnapped by local criminals, held for a few days. Mm-hmm. They took all your money. You were convinced they were going to kill you. How did you get out of that, and what does that kind of experience do to you?
I think, like a lot of negative experiences, it's one of those things that can destroy your innocence or your naivety, you know. And I went out of my way, as I think, you know, I probably did with my father leaving and stuff like that, to not let that change my approach to life and things, which is, you know, I'm really glad. But basically what happened was I was traveling alone in Thailand. It was the first time I'd been overseas by myself, and I was approached by some people. I mean, look, it's a long story. It's called Thai Dye. I did it as a show. Yeah, I ended up getting taken in by these people, and they had me for a few days. In the end, I was in this room where I was convinced they were going to come back and kill me. And it wasn't like I thought they were going to. I knew they were going to. I mean, as it turns out, I was wrong, but I totally knew they were going to kill me. I found all these blood stains in the room. I was totally freaked out. You know, they'd said to me, if you leave this room, you know, you'll basically be killed. But I thought, if I'm going to die, I'm not just going to sit here in this room waiting for it. I'm going to at least try and get out. I went charging out of this place, this motel in the middle of nowhere in the suburbs of Bangkok. And I was terrified. I was so terrified. It took me about 5 minutes to open the door. I kept going to open it and then not doing it. Finally, I just opened it and ran. And I went charging through this motel, and I could hear people behind me yelling, you know, and pointing at me and yelling. And I'm charging down these stairs, and I see the two big doors that open out to the outside world, to freedom. And I go, right, and I go charging down there, and I smash through those double doors. And as I open them, there's about six or eight young, really crimey looking Thai guys sitting out the front on the fronts of these cars. And they see me come charging out, and they all get up, and they're looking at me, and they all start yelling at me in Thai. I don't know what they're saying. But the main guy, like the sort of the leader or whatever, comes forward, and he's yelling something at me in Thai, and he's getting closer and closer. And I'm just like, what do you want? What do you want, man? If you want something from me, you get it now, because I am out of here, Jack. What do you want? He went, taxi? And it turned out they were taxi drivers sitting out the front of a motel on the fronts of their cars, as you would if you're a taxi driver in Bangkok.
I know you've spoken before about feeling lucky, that you feel that you've always had some kind of luck in your life. When you go through what you see as a near-death experience, did you take anything from that? Did it change the way you wanted to live, at least in the immediate sense?
I think if anything, it's kind of what I said before. It just made me not want to lose that naivety. Like, I wouldn't have got into that trouble. They were basically on the lookout for people who were traveling alone and people who were, you know, naive and kind of trusting. And they picked me, and it worked. You know, they got exactly what they wanted. But I just really wanted to make sure I didn't lose those qualities, because, you know, admittedly, if I didn't have those qualities, I wouldn't get into that kind of trouble. But by the same token, I think it really makes you who you are, and, you know, that trust or that naivety or whatever, and I just didn't want to lose that.
You've said before that you have some superstitious beliefs, and you've got particular rituals and routines. Right? And I understand that you smoked a lot of cigarettes in your life, but you take three quick puffs at the end of each one for life, love, one for you, one for love, one for having a really successful life. Where do these superstitious beliefs come from? Is it about thinking that there's some kind of fate or higher power or a god?
I've done that since I was 13. To virtually every cigarette that I've smoked. It's certainly not a religious thing, but it's more something to do with, with luck. You know, I've often thought, who am I directing this to when I make these requests? And some of them are more specific. Some of them can actually be about specific things that are happening in my life, you know, like I hope one for luck, one for me, and one for getting that job that I've just went for or whatever, you know. But there are general ones, which is what I usually do, but then there can also be specific ones. And but occasionally I do ones that are thank yous to whatever it is I'm requesting this stuff to. You know, when things have gone well, I occasionally do ones that are, you know, one for thanks, one from me and one to you. Whoever that is, you know, I don't know. I've never bothered picturing it, or it doesn't seem like it's a person or an entity. It's more like just a general life force energy kind of thing.
They sound like prayers.
I guess they are in a way. I mean, in a strange way, yeah, they probably are.
Let's talk about your funeral. A lot of people can spend many decades planning what it would be like, what the music they'd like to have played or sung, or who they want to be there. Is it something that you've ever given any thought to?
If anything, I would want it to be like a party or a celebration of my life with people who I'd known and got along with over the years, you know, being there and, you know, sharing stories about me and things like that. That would be kind of cool. Lawrence Mooney, who's a friend of mine, who's a performer, a comedian and actor, he's offered to do my eulogy and I've offered to do his. So whichever one of us dies first, the other one will do their eulogy. And so I'll be quite happy with that because he's, very gothic and funny.
What do you think he'd say?
Oh, he'd probably say a lot of things that weren't true as well as things that were. I mean, he'd use it as an opportunity to just show off and he'd, probably make up some mythical stories about things he and I had done, which we've never done. But, they'd be adventurous and exciting. I would want it to be fun. And that's where I think getting done as many things as I can in my life from this moment on will be great. If I can get some beautiful things done in the next 5 or 10 years, then when that time does come, people will go, well, he had a great life and he did all the things he wanted to do and it was, he was indulged himself and all that. And, and in the end, he still had time to create a couple of beautiful things that he wanted to do. And I'd want people to have fun there and, to tell stories and to laugh and to have a drink and just have a really good time and, and talk to my daughter about me and tell her things, that I'd done and not tell her other things that I'd done.
Now, you've called your daughter your greatest unconditional love. What advice do you want her to carry with her always?
Probably just to make sure you've got relationships where you can be honest with people and, you can talk to people and tell them exactly how you're feeling and, not bottle things up. She's very stoic. When it comes to me, like apparently a lot of the time, like if I don't see her for a couple of weeks, her mum will tell me that she's been really emotional or, she's been saying how much she wants to see me or whatever. And then, of course, when I do see her, she's like, oh, yeah, Dad, no worries. And she'll just get on her iPad and ignore me.
Kids today, Greg.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Young people, they've got no respect.
No.
She's great and she's got a fantastic mum. So, I think it's all cool.
Mm. One thing we didn't talk about, so if Lawrence gives your kind of semi-fictionalised eulogy, have you thought of music you might like played?
Look, it's really difficult, that kind of stuff, because I've just done a play and it's about a couple coming together over their love of music and then splitting up and, and having to split up their record collection and all the painful things associated with that. It's, comic drama. It would even be harder in a way for a funeral because with the play, it got down to which ones could we sing, conceivably. It would be harder with the funeral because it's not limited to what you can sing because you're actually just playing recorded music.
So what would you choose then?
There'd have to be some Bob Dylan in there. I love Bob Dylan.
Which one?
Oh, God.
This is important.
Tangled Up in Blue would be good.
Yeah.
Shelter from the Storm would be another good one for a funeral kind of thing. Mm. That would be a really key thing for my funerals. I'd want people to know how grateful I was for their support and, their love and stuff like that. I think Shelter from the Storm would reflect that. Absolutely. That would reflect that for my relationships with certain people, just people who take you out of a bad situation and offer you support and, kindness in the middle of a, basically a war zone. They're supporting you. That would be one of them. I would definitely want Bob Dylan. I would want some Velvet Underground, bizarrely.
Maybe Perfect Day.
Yeah, stuff like that. Maybe the Rolling Stones, certain songs of theirs, especially the more ballady ones, I guess, for a funeral.
We're almost out of time, but
oh wow, that was quick.
Just before we go, I mean, I've spent this whole time asking you about your observations about yourself. But one of the things about comedians is that they're sharp observers of humanity as well. What do you think you've learnt about humanity, about people?
I think one thing that I struggle with to this day is that most people see themselves as the center of the story. You know, most people see it as their story. And I've always assumed that everyone thinks it's my story, you know. And it's confronting for me to realize that everyone sees themselves as the center of their story, you know. That most people aren't walking around going, well, everything's about Greg Fleet and I'll serve that. You know, I'll fit into that and help to serve that and propel that along. Most people, strangely enough, are not doing that.
Well, today it has all been about you, Greg.
Thank God.
I hope we've taken you to your happy place.
Yeah, you have. It's time goes really fast when you're talking about yourself. Although, as a comedian, I guess you're used to that because that's all we really do.
Well, look, thanks so much for joining us from Swan Songs.
I hope I'm not dying now. The only thing that worried me when I did this was, you know, assuming I'm about to die.
No, not with your luck, not with your famous luck. This has just been a midlife reflection.
And as long as I just stay focused on creating beautiful things for myself and my daughter and the world, then I won't slip back into drugs and the dangers therein.
Excellent. All right. This has been Swan Songs on ABC RN with me, Julia Baird. My guest has been Greg Fleet. Let's go out on Shelter from the Storm, which Greg discussed as something that he wanted to show gratitude to people in his life. Of course, it's by Bob Dylan, and it seems very apt today.
Well, the deputy walks on hard nails and the preacher rides a mount. But nothing really matters much. It's doom alone that counts. And the one-eyed undertaker, he blows a feudal horn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
You've been listening to Swan Songs on RN. You can find details of the series on the RN homepage. Just look for Swan Songs. I've heard newborn babies wailing like a... Thank you for listening, and thanks to producers Fenella Souter and Diane Dean.
Do I understand your question, man? Is it hopeless and forlorn? Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.